folks, I'm so grateful that you're joining us for part two of my conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy, the author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I would hope that you'd jump back and listen to part one so that you can get the entire context of our conversation and especially understand how she came up with the reason for writing this book, which is controversial but enlightening. So let's pick up where we left off last time. In my role, I've been engaged with a number of national ministries that their fatherless boys is their target. And so I'm excited to share your book with those leaders and encourage them to pay attention to what you're saying in that research. Let me take this even further in digging into the challenge and the desire, the hunger to understand manhood. So I know you've got a couple of sons. We've got three sons. My wife and I have three sons and a daughter. All three of our boys have been to public universities. And so they grew up, I mean, they were kind of just grew up in this stew of biblical manhood and me as a men's ministry leader. So they get some things that their peers have not had exposure to. But in their secular schools, the young men around them are hungry to have some idea of what manhood should look like. And so it has become a tremendous opportunity for them to engage conversations because there's a hunger to figure out what does good and godly manhood look like? How do I grow up to be a good man? Which gives me a segue for you into the study that that you reported where this dichotomy of two views of manhood that folks wrestle with. So tell a little bit about that, and I'll share another thought on that as well.
Yeah, I really like this study. So I'll give you a little background that's not in the book.
Sure.
It has proven to be the most controversial book I've ever written. And that surprised me because my last book was Love Thy Body, which is on abortion,
body, right.
Sexuality, transgenderism, which is really exploding today. But this was more controversial. So I did classes on it. I did reading groups on it. And because I like to get a lot of feedback, rub off the rough edges. But they would tell their family and friends. And so people who had not actually read it were only getting it secondhand. The first question they always asked was, whose side is she on? You know, with that tone,
wow.
Whose side is she on? And men tended to just assume a book on men written by a woman, she was a male-bashing
right.
feminist, and more progressive people tend to assume I was some sort of defensive, angry reactionary. And so
right.
I put the study right at the front in order to say, look, you don't have to be either for or against. You can be for what's good. And you can critique what's bad. So this study was done by a sociologist who is not a Christian. He gets invited to speak all around the world. And so he came up with this really clever experiment. He would ask young men two questions. First, he would ask, what does it mean to be a good man? Like, if you're at a funeral and in the eulogy, somebody
right.
says he was a good man, what does that mean? And the sociologist said all around the globe, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately say duty, honor, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, look out
right.
for the little guy. I kind of like that one. Be a protector, be a provider, be responsible. And the sociologist would ask, where'd you learn that? And they'd say, well, I don't know, it's just in the air we breathe. Or if
right.
they were in a Western country, they would say it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage.
Hmm.
And then he would follow up with the second question, and he would say, what does it mean if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young men would say, oh, no, that's completely different. That means be tough, be strong, never show weakness, win at all costs, suck it up. What else? Be competitive, get rich, get laid. I'm using
right.
their language, of course.
Right.
And so the sociologist concludes, this is so interesting that young men do seem to be caught between two competing scripts. That on the one hand, they inherently, innately know what it means to be a good man. you and I would say they are made in God's image. And so
right.
they
exactly.
do know what it means. Or you could also maybe say it's part of general revelation. You know, what people can
mm-hmm.
know apart from the Bible. You know, God's truth that can be known to everyone. And on the other hand, they feel this cultural pressure in many places
right.
to be the real man. And those are the traits that most of us might consider more toxic, especially if decoupled from a moral ideal. And it suggests a way that we can deal with these issues, by the way, too. Instead of accusing men of being toxic, which most men don't respond very well to, surprise, surprise, you know, right. Can we tap into their inherent knowledge of what it means to be the good man? Romans 2 as well, right? We all have a conscience. You know, can we tap into and encourage what they already know? And like you were saying, they aspire to be a good man. And then help them to think critically more about the secular script that's out there. The Andrew Tate script that, you know, help them to think through, you know, which one do they really aspire to be? Because I do think that I totally agree with you. I think most men do aspire to be the good man. They often just haven't been equipped. They haven't been trained. They haven't been taught. And there's actually a book. You'd love this book. There's a book with the title Good Men. Oh, it's called When Good Men Behave Badly. Right. And he was acknowledging most men are good men, even when they're behaving badly. So I think that's what we see a lot of.
Well, I think we take some of those things that can allow men to, that you can find in both those categories, like risk tolerance. So young men are likely to take risk. And are they going to take risks that just are destructive, or are they going to take risks that are constructive? And so how is that challenged, or how is it channeled? Actually, after reading your book, I had an audience with some seminary students. And so I did that exercise. And they were able to come up with, you know, with the same sorts of categories. Now, these are guys that feel called to ministry, and they're there for a purpose, but they still could give this list of things that what the culture would say a real man would look like, and then what a good man would look like. And here's one of the interesting the things that precipitated out of that. You can have the things that are listed in the real man category at almost any moment. I mean, you could get rich, you could get laid, you could get a fast car, you could do a lot of those things. But the character that comes with being a good man takes time to develop, and you have to be disciplined and have patience. And then the things that speak to being a real man may bring happiness, but the things that speak to being a good man can bring joy. And so young men get caught between, I can have this now, or I can wait and work and I can have this. And our culture short sells us on the easy, quick reward rather than the long-term benefit, really an eternal perspective on what good and godly manhood looks like. Does that make sense and resonate with you?
Yeah, totally. The Institute for Family Studies does a lot of studies, and I got a lot of my research through them, but they just posted an article, a study showing that married men with children are the happiest. You know, you have single men, single fathers with children, married men, and married men with children. And it, you know, the curve went up and up and up, showing that married men with children are happiest. And I think it is counter to the cultural messages that a lot of young men get. In fact, I saw this on Twitter just yesterday, and I'm sure it's from some guy who's on the manosphere, because he was saying to be a high quality, you know, high value male, be single, be rich, you know, have a good car. One thing after another, but it started with no kids, no marriage. And I thought, okay, that's the message that they're sending, you know, to be, you know, again, it's a shorthand now, but the Andrew Tate form of masculinity. Let me give you one more positive study, because the more encouragement we get, the better. So this was a study. It was the first ever study done of cross-cultural concepts of masculinity. And done by an anthropologist, not a Christian. And what was interesting about it was he found that no matter how they differed in their definition of masculinity, because some cultures, you know, were more warlike, some were more peaceful, whatever, but all of them shared the idea, the ideal, that the good man performs what he called the three P's: provide, protect, and procreate, become a father, build into the next generation. And I thought that was so cool, because it was another confirmation. Again, it was global. So these aren't only nations with a Christian background. It is inherent in men, that they know that their unique masculine strengths, because they are stronger than women, you know, they're stronger, larger, faster. And as you mentioned, because of testosterone, they're more aggressive, they're more risk-taking. And we need to affirm those as good. You know, this is the basic right. equipment that God has given them. And we need to affirm those as good. But what the study showed is men intrinsically know that those special strengths were not given them just to get whatever they want, you know, but right. given them to provide for and protect and take care of the people that they love. And again, I find that just so encouraging that men sure. have that innate sense. And our goal is to tap into it, you know, help them to Absolutely. Recognize that that is their true fulfillment.
Right. That's the general revelation again that you, I mean, it's God's, it's the Imago Dei in them that believes that there is a purpose in what I'm doing. And I can relate to God the Father through this. One of the things that I find fascinating, and I don't know that you covered this in the book, but I'm seeing more and more progressive women, especially, ask the question, where do I find a man to marry? Because they champion all of these ideals of what we might consider a soft man, someone who's, you know, kind of warm and fuzzy or whatever. But when it comes down to it, they want to affirm those things. But then there was one viral video where this girl said, well, I want someone who's going to pay for my dinner, who's going to open the door for me, but I don't want him to be a conservative. And she ended by saying, am I asking too much? Am I trying to have my cake and eat it too? And the answer is yes. I mean, and then I'll throw one more thing out. The other piece that I'm reading in some of these articles and posts is they have all of these ideals until they have a son and they begin to ask, how do I raise a son that is going to be potentially a good father or a good provider or a good protector? And so they are running in many cases into this roadblock that says, yeah, I believe all these things, oh, but there's this problem. So are you seeing that challenge in front of you and as people talk about these issues?
Well, one of the ones that's most clear is that more women than men are going to college now. Mm-hmm. The average college is now 60% female, 40% male. And smaller private colleges are worse often. When I first started here at yep. Houston Christian University, it was 70-30, 70% female. Wow. And to push back on that, we started a football team and we started an engineering department to try to bring better balance. But what it means is, and again, this was an article I saw just, I think it was today on Twitter. On Twitter, things go by so quickly, you forget when you saw it.
Right.
But there was an article very recently on Twitter that was saying, you know, where are women going to find men, especially college-educated women? Because, right. of course, they want somebody who's kind of on their level in terms of education, in terms of income, in terms of culture, and so on. And they're not finding them anymore. So
that's right.
this is a problem that I wouldn't say that women have created it, but it goes all the way back to kindergarten, right? Boys are falling behind at all levels. It's not I started with college because we were talking about finding a mate,
right?
But really, it goes right. back to kindergarten. Boys are falling behind at all levels of education. You know, even in kindergarten, they don't have the fine motor controls to, you know, to handle the right. scissors, and so already in kindergarten, they're feeling like, you know, I'm dumber. I'm dumber than my female right. classmates, and it goes all the way up through, you know, all through high school. You know, girls are more likely to get good grades, more likely to be president of the extracurricular clubs, and so on. And it started because of, well, Title IX, for one thing, and then the 1994 Gender Equity Act, which poured right. millions of dollars into helping girls, into, you know, equity workshops and training materials and curriculum and so on. And in one sense, that's great. You know, we're not sounding like we think it's bad for girls to get ahead. It's great they're getting ahead. But it's just right. that there's been nothing comparable for boys. Like right, right. now, depending on what you read, there's four or more times. I saw one article saying four times as many scholarships for women as for men.
Right.
I saw another article that said it was 10 times. So I'm not sure which one is correct. But there are a lot more scholarships for women than for men. And we have, you know, girls are getting affirmation and support, and boys aren't. And if you try to implement a program for boys, it gets shut down. So the first person to write on this was Christina Hoff Sommers. You might know her book. It was called The War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
The War on Boys. And she reports that when they tried to have any kind of programs to help boys, anything targeted for boys was quickly shut down by feminist organizations. And so they've had a terrible time trying to get anything for boys. Have you seen the most recent book is Richard Reeves. He's at the Brookings Institution, and it's called Of Boys and Men. And so it's the latest attempt to say, can't we please have some programs that are targeted for boys? We need to have compassion on these boys. We need to give them we need to equip them. If you want boys to grow up into healthy, respectful, you know, high-achieving men, you've got to give them the tools, and we're not doing that at this point.
Well, and our culture is going to continue to suffer for that, and we're seeing the ramifications of it. I tell you, as you talk about the education thing, part of what echoes in my mind is sadness about the fact that we in the church are doing very similar things with not working to raise up young boys or to teach young boys. I mean, we're using some of the very same pedagogy strategies in church environments that we're using in school environments. And boys are, I mean, what's there for the little boy that likes to play differently? And where are the men who are working with little boys? And so we end up with some of those challenges as well. The church has kind of fallen into that same pattern that we could work on.
Yes, yes. The average U.S. congregation is 60% women, 40% men.
Right.
So again, with all that, with so many women running the Sunday school classes and running the nursery and so on, boys are not being mentored by men to a large extent, even at church. And so that's
even
why people
church,
talk about the feminization of the church. You know, if And it's been that way, by the way, it's been that way since the early church. And the church fathers talk about how already back then there were more women than men. But it was for a different reason, I think. Back then it was because the Roman culture had such a low view of women.
Church was a safe place for women.
It was
there.
A safe place. And they had much more stature, much more dignity in the church. The Roman culture was very negative toward women, right? They thought they were very inferior. Abortion and infanticide was practiced mostly against baby girls. It was very rare for a Roman family to have more than one token daughter. And then, of course, the sexual ethic, if you want to call it an ethic, that Roman men were expected to have sex with just about anyone, you know, and that's completely socially acceptable. Prostitutes and courtesans and mistresses but most of all, slaves. Your slaves were fair game. By the way, both women and men, because homosexuality was rampant, both adults and children. Right. So yes, a woman who became a Christian, you know, in the Christian world, she didn't have to compete with all those other people for her husband's love.
Right.
When I was writing my earlier book, Love Thy Body, I actually read a Roman writer writing to a married woman and admonishing her not to be jealous when her husband had sex with a slave boy. And he said, because we all know that sex with boys is more pleasurable. So that's what Roman women were up against. You can see why they flocked to the Christian church. So it's been that way from the beginning. But these days, I do think that we need to talk about how to make our churches more friendly to men. There's a book called, have you seen the book, Why Men Hate Going to Church?
Why Men Hate Going to a Church. Yeah, David Murrow is a friend. So,
oh, good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and his website, Church for Men, has a lot of sort of simple, basic things that churches can do to make the church, you know, starting with the decor, make it more manly, don't have pastels. Get rid of the Kleenex boxes at the end of the pew. They're very practical, and it works. You know, a lot of his suggestions, I think, work in attracting men on at least the superficial level. Why not start there?
You know, we talk about the patriarchy, And the term patriarchy is just completely maligned these days. There's almost no context in where in which it seems to be used in a positive light. But Dennis Rainey from Family Life lists the patriarchy as the highest level of achievement for a man when he reaches a point where he is caring for, loving, and praying over his children, his grandchildren, and he gets to love them. It seems like a wonderful godly representation of mature manhood. So can we redeem patriarchy? Is it just completely shot? I mean, what does biblical patriarchy look like in today's times?
Well, you know, history is great because it gives us alternatives. And so in the book, I do go to the back to the colonial era. It's, I mean, that's America still. Right. That's not biblical times. So it's a little closer in history. But in the colonial era, pre-industrial age, men worked all day alongside their wives and children on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the cultural ethos for manhood was very much of a caretaking role and responsibility for their family. In fact, the very word authority had a very specific meaning at the time. What it meant was that authority was the person responsible for the common good. In other words, I look out for mm-hmm. what's good for me, you look out for what's good for you, but who looks out for the common good of the marriage itself or the family itself or the church or the civil society? And that's what the person in authority was to do. He was to be disinterested, a word we don't understand right. too much anymore today. But what that means is he's not to look out for his own interest. You know, he was the one who was supposed to right. selflessly look out for the good of the whole. And we've kind of lost that. In fact, you'll love this. The literature on parenting in the colonial era was addressed to fathers. Not to women, not to yes. mothers. Like if you go to a bookstore today, you know, most of the books are written to mothers. But back then, they really thought the father was the primary parent. And they were especially important
there were there were no mommy bloggers back then?
Mommy bloggers. I love that idea that, you know, they were holding men, fathers responsible for the
right?
family. Oh, and this too. Not only were they responsible for their families, but a common phrase back then was that they were held responsible for being fathers of the community. That was a word mm-hmm. at the time as well. In other words, they were supposed to bring their fathering out into the community and have that. The good meaning of the word patriarchy is that I'm bringing a fatherly tone into my interaction even outside the home. And how did we lose that? Well, we did lose it with the Industrial Revolution because it took work out of the home. And of course, men had to follow yeah. their work out of the home. And for the first time, they were not working alongside the family members, people they loved and had a moral bond with. Instead, they were working as individuals in competition with other men. And that's when the language started to change. That's when people at the time began to say, men are losing their caretaking ethos. You know, they are,
right.
they're becoming egocentric, self-centered, greedy, ambitious, acquisitive, look out for number one, make it at all costs. That kind of language right. starts to permeate the literature. I mean, people were protesting. They didn't like what they were seeing.
Right.
But that's what the first time you see negative language applied to the masculine character. And what I do in the book then is I show how the secular script developed over time. You know, so because I want us to be able to say where did it you can't stand against a social trend unless you know where did it come from and how did it develop. And so a lot of the book.
Exactly. And I appreciated so much the arc of history that you drew with starting in the colonial era, going through Industrial Revolution, and then talking about the abolitionist and the, trying to get rid of alcohol.
Temperance.
What was that called? That's
temperance movement.
Temperance movements. And then muscular Christianity. I mean, men have behaved badly and the church has tried to respond to that in different ways. And so reading that historical arc was enlightening. And that's worth the book itself, just getting a picture, historical background of how we got to where we are is valuable. So let me ask you one more question that gets a little personal, and then we'll finish this up. You open the book by talking about your two dads. And you say, I had a public dad who I'm just going to use my terms, was squared away and respected, and he made sure that his family got to church, and he was an upstanding man in the community. But behind closed doors, he became a different guy, abusive, hateful even, and dangerous. I mean, he became a toxic guy. And so I wonder, Patrick Morley talks about a holy moment when a dad reaches for the door on the local church and opens it to take his family into the church. I don't know if you know Patrick Morley.
Just the name.
Writer of Man in the Mirror. Mm-hmm. But he talks about that holy moment. And I just wonder, I know your dad was taking you guys to church. What could the church do for a man like Nancy Piercy's dad? How do we get into a space where we can help a man and help a family? Because there are families out there suffering like you and your siblings did. I know that's happening. How can the church helpfully respond to that? And I hope that's not too personal to press in on here.
Well, but I wrote about it, so I better be ready to talk about it, right? I did grow up in a very abusive home. Books on abuse will sometimes ask, was it open hand or closed fist? And it was right. Closed fist. Yeah. And in fact, he made a knuckle fist like that for a sharper stab of pain. But he was very careful to always hit us where it would not make bruises, visible bruises. So never in the face, right? Always under the clothes, you know, so we'd have bruises under the clothes. So that's why nobody knew, right? Because it wasn't showing. We weren't coming to school with black eyes and so on. Looking back, I realized, you know, he was being very careful.
Right.
Let me answer first in terms of how I got healing, because a Christian psychologist interviewed me and he said, when I first opened your book and read that story, I thought, oh no, you know, and an abused woman, she's going to be angry at men. And then he said, actually, no, the book is very supportive,
right,
and very positive. Yes. But that's because I got healing early on in my Christian life. The story of my conversion, which I won't go into all the way here, but it was through Le Bris, which was the ministry of Francis Schaeffer. And he's known mostly for his apologetics ministry. And of course, that's what, you know, got me first. You know, I had a lot of intellectual questions. I'd absorbed a lot of secular isms. I'd never met Christians who could engage with those secular isms. And so I was blown away. I was very impressed. But also, and that is how I became a Christian, but on staff at Le Bris was a psychiatric social worker. Her name was Sheila Bird, and we called her Birdie. And I don't usually add this detail, but I'll add it for you. So the reason I went to Le Bris, people say, why did you go to a Christian ministry if you weren't a Christian? I went to Le Bris because my family was traveling across Europe to get to the cheap Luxembourg flights. My dad had been teaching in the Middle East, and without going into detail. And somebody told him, well, if you're driving across Europe, you should stop at this Christian place called Le Bris. And my father, you know, so they were sort of the first touristy Christians to go to Le Bris. But here's the deal. So I came down to Le Bris to see my family. You know, I didn't go there to go to a Christian place. I went there because my family said, hey, we're stopping at this place, and come down and see us. And so the upshot of that is that Birdie, the psychiatric social worker, saw my father. He actually saw my father. And she told me later, I looked at your father and I thought, there is a man who oppresses everyone around him. So she could see it. And of course, then she knew what to talk to me about. You know, when I came to see her and talk with her, she said, she zeroed in on my relationship with my father. But I thought that was fascinating. Now, what if, to answer your question, what if churches could do that? What if nobody spotted my father? Nobody else did that I know of, at least.
Right.
But Birdie spotted it. She could see, even in his demeanor, that he was a harsh, overbearing person. And by the way, she watched the rest of our family, too, and saw that there was no cohesion. There was no relationships. You know, when you're growing up in an abusive home, it filters down to, you know, poor relationships in the whole family. And she saw all of that just watching us for an evening. So what about that? I would love it if churches could have you know, enough to train people, even part-time on staff, to deal with abuse. You know, in the chapters on abuse at the end of the book, I do say it's probably time for churches to start having some kind of specialized staff, you know, even if you can't afford full-time, to help with abuse issues, because it's too much to ask for pastors, right? I mean, pastors haven't...
Absolutely.
they have enough on their plate, and they're not trained this way. But a few trained people could go a long way, maybe, in helping to spot it and to begin to minister to those families.
And I think one of the things that's one of the unicorns in the Christian world is a male counselor. And that's really hard to find. There are very few of them around here in our area. But to find a counselor that men would feel comfortable speaking with, I think is very valuable. So I'm loving when I can find a guy that I trust to send other men to unpack, because there's often trauma. I mean, there is often a reason why these guys have they're toxic. And so we've got to unravel the knot and get back to that. So
absolutely. I think almost always there's a father wound or some other trauma in the background. And, you know, the tricky thing is to recognize that, but still not let them off the hook. You know,
Exactly.
I understand you have these issues. That doesn't mean you can hit your wife, you know, or your kids.
That's right. I mean, we can't condone sin. We can't condone bad behavior. And so we do want to move these men to the healthy, evangelical, wife-loving, kid-raising, godly men. The 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1 men that Paul identifies for Timothy and Titus. Well, listen, you've been so generous with your time, and I have enjoyed this conversation. I feel like we could go on and on. I do want to tell folks, buy this book. Mine is so marked up that I probably need another one. I've just got so many notes. I enjoyed it. It has become a landmark tool in my ministry to men through local churches. And so I'll hold up my copy of it. I'll just push it out there. And so, Nancy, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the work and the energy that you've invested in this, and for the impact it's going to have on the kingdom. We just give God glory for that.
Oh, so, thank you. And it really, it's quite an honor to me to talk with someone whose ministry focuses on men. You know, I really appreciate the work you're doing. I hope I talk to a lot more men's ministries, because what you're doing is just so valuable.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much. Folks, check out nancypiercy.com, I think, is the website, so you can read about all of our other books. And this particular book, get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold. I think you can order it on the website as well. But folks, we want you to get this type of information, because if you're investing in men in any way, the insights that Nancy unpacks in this book are going to be useful to you as you help to disciple men. So check that out. Nancy Piercy, thank you so much for being with us. This has been a blessing today.
Thanks for having me. I do appreciate it.